queue called RAA questions at ICANN.org, which is really intended for registrars to be able to ask questions about the new agreement. And so what happens generally is the registrar questions that come to that address are primarily fielded by Caitlin and Owen. And when there are questions where we don't know the answer, we'll occasionally bring in the legal team to give us some guidance. And so we do our best to try to be responsive to these questions from registrars, and we're aware that there's occasionally areas where it's not perfectly clear. So today we've taken some of the most frequently asked questions through that ticketing queue and through some of the webinars that we've done, and we'll try to present those to you. We'll give a brief presentation on that, and then we'll open up the floor to questions and answers. With just one further little bit of housekeeping, we've got remote participation, so people who are in who are not in the room but have questions, feel free to ask them online. I think the schedule reflects that this is a 90-minute session, but we've actually planned for a 60-minute session. So just please be aware that we'll end at the, not the top of the hour, but half past the hour. So without further ado, I would like to hand it over to my colleague, Caitlin.
Thank you, Mike. And good afternoon, everyone. Good morning and good evening to our remote participants. My name is Caitlin Tebergen, and I am the Registrar Relations and Contracts Manager here at ICANN. I wanted to begin with an agenda of some of the topics we'll be covering in today's session. We'll start with a couple of 2013 RAA statistics, followed by how to request the 2013 RAA and the process time associated with that. Next, we'll talk about some of the new website posting requirements, followed by the Who is Accuracy program specification, and then the Registrar Data Directory Services specification, also known as the Who is specification. We'll then talk a little bit about dealings with resellers under the 2013 RAA, and then also the expedited transfer of accreditation mechanism to wholly owned subsidiaries. And lastly, I will be handing it over to Owen Smigelski from our compliance department, and he will talk about some of the common compliance issues associated with the 2013 RAA. So the following slide has some graphics on it that represent the amount of registrars that have adopted the 2013 RAA. So as you can see on your left, approximately 33% of registrars have adopted the 2013 RAA. And also, as of last week, there are no longer any registrars under the 2001 RAA. These statistics are as of last Friday, by the way. And as you can see on the right, approximately 83% of domain names under management are now under the 2013 RAA, so that's a good statistic. One of the most frequently asked questions we get is how to adopt the 2013 RAA early. And if you visit our website where the 2013 agreement is, there is a form, an early adoption form, which you can complete and submit to ICANN pursuant to the instructions on the form. When ICANN receives the form, we'll acknowledge receipt and proceed to run a preliminary compliance check on the registrar. The registrar should allow between 7 and 14 days for that compliance check. And assuming everything checks out, ICANN will send the registrar information specification to the registrar, which is a document in the agreement that essentially has some questions that the registrar needs to fill out and provide to ICANN. Many of the data elements are similar to what the registrar would provide when it initially applied for accreditation. And then ICANN will send the 2013 agreement to the registrar via DocuSign, which is an online signing tool. If the registrar instead would prefer a hard copy of the agreement, there are instructions on how to request that when you receive the agreement. So now I'll talk a little bit about requirements on for registrars' websites. So Section 3.7.10 of the RAA requires that registrars provide a link to the benefits and responsibilities specification. A link has been provided on this slide. Also, Section 3.16 of the 2013 RAA requires registrars to provide a link to registrant educational information. And similarly, a link has been provided on this slide. And just a couple of notes about those links. The link should be either on the registrar's homepage or one or two clicks away from the registrar's homepage. So this shouldn't be something that someone trying to find this information has to click 14 links to receive. This slide represents some of the elements of the registrar information specification that need to be posted to registrars' websites. So when you look at the registrar information specification, there are a couple of elements that are marked with an asterisk, and those need to be published on the registrar's homepage. And so I've included those up on the slide. And I just wanted to make a note about item 17, which is the full name, contact information, and position of all officers of the registrar. What needs to be posted on the website is the full name and position of the officers. The contact information does not need to be on the registrar's homepage. Lastly, section 3.18 of the agreement talks about abuse contact postings. So section 3.18.1 provides that registrars need to publish an email address to receive abuse reports. And I wanted to make a note about that, that that does need to be an actual email address. A contact us form is not compliant with the agreement. Section 3.18.3 provides that registrars need to provide a description of the registrar's procedures for the handling, tracking, and receipt of abuse reports. Next, we'll just talk a little bit about who is accuracy and the Registrar Data Directory Services specification. So the Who is Accuracy program specification is required for all GTLDs as of the 1st of January of this year. And I wanted to emphasize that is for all GTLDs. I've gotten a couple of questions about some registrars thinking that it's different between legacy GTLDs and new GTLDs, but it is required as of the 1st of January for all GTLDs. The Who is Accuracy specification requires the validation and verification of registrant and account holder data in certain circumstances. And in the following slides, I'll describe a little bit about the differences between verification and validation. And also, the deletion or suspension of domain name registrations is now explicitly required in certain cases that are mentioned in the agreement. So section 3.7.7.2 requires deletion or suspension of domain name registrations for the willful provision of inaccurate or unreliable data. Section 3.7.7.2 also provides that for the deletion or suspension of domain name registrations for the willful failure to update data promptly. And the agreement defines promptly as 7 days. And the Who is Accuracy spec requires that the deletion or suspension of names if the registered name holder doesn't respond to a Who is Accuracy request. So Who is Validation? The Who is Validation is required for registrant and account holder data within 15 days of the registration, transfer in, or registrant or account holder data change. And for Who is Validation, the registrar is just checking that all the required fields are filled, and they're filled according to certain standards. And those standards are specified on the slide. I won't bore you and read through all of them. I did want to make a note that the cross-field validation requirement in the Who is Accuracy specification is not required yet, and that's something mentioned in the transition addendum. That won't be required until the working group and ICANN reach mutual agreement on a technically feasible way to perform cross-field validation. So Who is Verification is required similarly within 15 days of the registration, transfer in, or registrant account holder data change. The registrar needs to verify that the email address or telephone number is accurate, and that's found in section 1F of the Who is Accuracy specification. And the Who is Verification as opposed to Who is Validation requires an affirmative response from the registered name holder. So the registered name holder does have to verify that, yes, this is my phone number, or yes, this is my email address. Exceptions to the Who is Accuracy specification. So the verification and validation are not required if the registrar has already previously performed the verification and validation on identical data and the registrar has no reason to believe the data has become inaccurate or invalid. And an example of a reason to believe that the information has become inaccurate or invalid would be an email bounce back would suggest that the email is no longer valid. Now I'm just going to go through a couple of who is inaccuracy examples, and I know that Owen will be going through a couple more later in the presentation. So if a registered name holder updates its postal address, the registrar must validate that the postal address is in the proper format, and the proper format is defined in Section 1D of the Who Is Accuracy specification. However, the registrar would not be required to re-verify the email address or the telephone number of the registered name holder. If the registered name holder updates its email address, the registrar has to validate that the email address is in the proper format, and the proper format can be found in 1D of the Who Is Accuracy specification. The registrar would also have to verify that email address if the registrar had chosen to verify the email address further to Section 1F1 of the agreement. If instead the registrar chose to verify the telephone number, the registrar would not have to verify the email address unless it has a reason to believe that that data is no longer accurate. If the registered name holder updates its telephone number, the registrar must validate that the telephone number is in the proper format, and that can be found in Section 1C of the Who Is Accuracy Program specification. The registrar would also have to verify the telephone number if the registrar had verified the telephone number further to Section 1F2. If the registrar instead chose to verify the email address, the registrar would not have to verify the telephone number. So now we'll go through some of the new requirements of the Registrar Data Directory Services specification. So all of the requirements for WHOIS can be found in the Registrar Data Directory Service specification, also known as the WHOIS specification. There are additional fields required now in the registrar's WHOIS output. There is a uniform WHOIS query and output format, and the WHOIS output format should be in the exact order that is specified in the WHOIS, in the RDDS specification. EPP status values are exclusively required now for domain name statuses. There is now an SLA for WHOIS service, and that can be found in Section 2.2 of the specification. IPv6 accessibility is now required, and port 43 access is only required now for thin registries. However, a web-based WHOIS access is required for all registries. This slide shows all of the new WHOIS fields that are required as of January 1st. And again, I won't go through and read them all, but on the next slide, I'll make a couple of points about some of the fields that registrars have asked questions about. So for the registry domain ID, this is a field that doesn't change for the length of the entire domain name registration. For the field for the registrar abuse, contact, email, and phone, those fields do have to have an actual email address and an actual phone number, but it's up to the registrar's discretion who they'd like to use for that. Domain name statuses are exclusively EPP status codes. And the registry registrant ID, the registry admin ID, and the registry tech ID may be left blank if they're unavailable from the registry. And lastly, I did get a lot of questions about the DNSSEC field, and there are two options for the output on that field, and I've displayed those below, signed delegation and unsigned. Section 3.12 of the 2013 RAA has certain requirements that the registrars must ensure that their resellers are doing. For example, displaying certain links on their website. And a common question is, well, how can we ensure that our resellers are doing something? And so up on the slide is a non-exhaustive list of how registrars can ensure that their resellers are indeed doing something. And so, for example, when it comes to website links, the registrar can implement some sort of monitoring process whereby the registrar periodically looks at the reseller's websites to ensure that those links are there. Also, the registrar can include in their reseller agreement consequences for contract noncompliance when the reseller is indeed not doing something and is causing the registrar to be in breach of the agreement? The compliance certificate is a requirement in Section 3.15 of the RAA, and for registrars that had signed on to the RAA in 2013, all of you should have received a compliance certificate via DocuSign to sign. For registrars that signed the agreement this year in 2014, the compliance certificate will be issued early in 2015 to sign. And another commonly asked question is regarding Section 7.3.1 of the RAA, and that is the transfer of accreditation to the registrar's wholly owned subsidiary. So up on the slide, I've included the required documentation if the registrar would indeed like to transfer their accreditation to a wholly owned subsidiary. So in the event that the registrar would like to do that, it needs to provide documentation proving that the transferee entity or the wholly owned subsidiary is in fact a wholly owned subsidiary of the registrar. And that could perhaps be a stock certificate or articles of incorporation or some sort of legal document evidencing that fact. Also, the ICANN-accredited registrar would need to provide a letter on its company letterhead acknowledging that it would like to transfer its accreditation to its wholly owned subsidiary. And the wholly owned subsidiary would need to provide a letter on its company letterhead acknowledging that it assumes and will be responsible for the existing registrar's obligations and liabilities. And also, the registrar can submit a primary contact update if it's applicable. So now I will be handing the presentation over to Owen, and he's going to talk about some common compliance issues that the compliance department has seen.
Thank you, Caitlin. Next slide, please. What I'm going to go over here is what compliance has seen since the 2013 RAA has gone into force. Most of the concerns that we've seen have been regarding those things that went into effect on January 1st of 2014. Because the transition addendum no longer applies to those, these are things that are effective when the registrar executes the agreement. So the first area we've seen some issues with have been who is an accuracy complaints with regards to verification and validation. As Caitlin mentioned, registrars do need to verify or re-verify email addresses of registered name holders, and that's even if the who is an accuracy complaint is about, say, the postal address. Another issue that we've been seeing with registrars is that the registrars are required to suspend a domain name after 15 calendar days if there is no verification or there needs to be some sort of manual verification by the registrar. And compliance will start inquiring about that after the second notice. There are also two concurrent parallel tracks that we're looking for who is an accuracy complaints. The first one is based upon Section 3.7.8 of the RAA, as well as Section 5 of the who is accuracy specification. In this instance, the registrar has to take reasonable steps to investigate and reasonable steps to correct the inaccuracy. And this is where the 15-day timeline is started when the registrar sends an inquiry to the registered name holder. Compliance is going to be looking for three different results. The first one is that the who is was updated and that the registrar provides validation and, if needed, verified the updates to that. The other option we're looking for is if the domain was suspended. And the third is that the registrar verified that the who is correct and that there was documentation of verification for that. Next slide. The other track that we're looking for is pursuant to Specification 4. And this one's a little bit different. The 15-day calendar timeline is started when the registrar receives a notice, and so compliance will be counting that starting with the day after compliance sends that notice. And this is where the registrar must verify or re-verify the registered name holder's email, and if it's different, the account holder. One difference we've seen is in the past, what had been done was a registrar, if they were testing an email address, would send an email and state that there were no bounce backs, and that would show that there was a valid email address. That is no longer the case under the 2013 RAA. There must be an affirmative response from the registrant demonstrating receipt of the email, and that can be accomplished from the registrant clicking a link in the email, providing a validation code, calling the registrar, but there must be some action on behalf of the registrant for that. The registrar can do manual verification, but we would need to see some documentation, specifically the date, the time, the method that verification occurred. Next slide, please. So this is a representation of those two parallel tracks. Compliance is going to maintain the 15 business day notice period for the who is an accuracy complaints, just so that we can be sure that if there's delays with sending the notices or the registrar processing and sending it to the registered name holder, that would allow that either of those 15-day periods to expire before the time for ICANN to follow up and do a second notice. So here you see there's a who is an accuracy complaint that goes to the registrar, who then must verify the email and investigate the complaint. If the complaint is about the email address, then only one of the tracks applies. But if it is, say, the address, that would have to go through a separate process on the right, where on the left also there is the verification of the email that has to occur. Next slide, please. The 2013 RAA has abuse report requirements. Caitlin went over some of them earlier. And what we're seeing is that law enforcement complaints aren't just from ones from a local jurisdiction. They can be from any applicable jurisdiction. With regards to, and those reports have to be responded to within 24 hours. You don't necessarily have to answer the phone, but they do need to be addressed and responded to appropriately within that time frame. As for abuse reports from the general public, registrars must take reasonable and prompt steps to investigate and respond appropriately. What we're looking for in compliance is, did the registrar receive it? What did they do with it? And what steps did they take to address that complaint? And that can certainly vary based upon the type of complaint and the severity of the of what the allegation is. We will check to see that if somebody submits a complaint that a registrar did not respond, we're going to confirm whether the reporter actually did file the complaint with the registrar, and if they provided sufficient information to the registrar. It's not just they can't say domain xyz.com is bad. There needs to be some supporting documentation to assist the registrar in investigating that and taking the appropriate action. Another thing we've seen from registrars is them stating that they're not taking any action because it would require a court order. If a registrar takes that position, they do need to provide ICANN with a specific local law or regulation that states they need to have a court order in order to investigate an abuse report. Next slide, please.
So now we'd like to open up for Q&A. So if anyone has any questions, please approach the mic. Also, we will take questions from remote participants now if there are any.
Wernstein from CORE, just about the email address verification. You know, we get the questions, for people who have long established, contacts, email addresses that have been used for, many years. And when a new domain is added to a portfolio, our, for instance, our members, so this kind of actually, really bothersome for the for the customer to suddenly be told to have to re-verify an email? Is there anything like a statute and, you know, a long-established, you know, used email address in correspondence could actually be just be verified by the fact that's been used in correspondence before?
That was a question that came up during a registrar stakeholder group similar. There's no requirement that for a domain that was registered before the Whois accuracy program spec came into play on January 1st. There's no requirement to go back and do that unless the registrar does receive information suggesting that that information is incorrect. Compliance doesn't forward every complaint to the registrar automatically. We review it to see if there is sufficient information to support the allegation of the inaccuracy. So it won't be just a blind report or just, you know, something for harassing. And even if it is something that's there, that's what is the what's in the contract, and all we're doing is ensuring compliance with that. So that would be something we would need to see demonstrated that you know, if it's not the case that there is an accuracy, you have that information, it is good. That's where you mail the invoices to. You know, then that would qualify as manual verification.
Mm-hmm. So, but even if there is no inaccuracy complaint, basically, if a new domain is being registered, you know, would you then have to say, okay, now the new domain is being registered, added to an existing portfolio, everything is as has been for many years, would then an email address verification be necessary?
That is the requirement of the RAA.
Owen, yeah. This is Mike Zupke for people who are participating remotely. Could you clarify for us, though, that once an email address has been verified, whether the registrar would need to do that again?
This is Owen. The question was: is that if it's a new registration that's being done, would the email address need to be verified at the time of registration?
Well, right. So the question is: if a registrant registers a domain name and uses identical contact data for another registration the second time, would they need to re-verify all of that data, such as the email address?
It needs to be validated, not necessarily verified at the time of registration. The affirmative response is only for the email address at the time of registration.
Sorry, I didn't mean this to be a trick question. So I think Caitlin had a slide that maybe addressed this. I don't know if you want to flip back to that. I think what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, we understand that there's going to be a learning curve for customers who have been interacting with registrars in a particular way for a very long period of time, that some of these new requests or new requirements will be placed on them. But I think in terms of the overall burden on them, you know, it's not – my understanding of the contract is that once the data has been validated or verified, it doesn't need to be validated or verified again unless there's information suggesting that it's become inaccurate, right?
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I overlooked spec 3.
Thank you.
Okay, that's what I want to know.
Would anyone else like to ask a question? Remote participants?
And just to be clear, it doesn't necessarily have to be a question about something that you heard in the presentation. Anything related to the new registrar accreditation agreement is fair game.
Terrific. I'm glad you said that. This is Kathy Klein, a non-commercial users constituency. And for those of us who haven't been part of the debate, we've been in other sessions, could you reflect the discussion going on data retention right now and kind of the status with the registrars, the exception requests, and, you know, from our perspective as non-commercial users, the protections that were given under national laws that allow our data to be deleted when it's no longer being used? Thank you. I'll stay up here to listen.
So this is Mike Zupke again. I volunteered to answer the question, and suddenly I'm full of regret. it's a complicated issue, and so I wasn't planning on answering questions today, but I'm going to try this. So The question is referring to data retention specification that, in addition to all of the data points that registrars were previously required to retain, there are now some additional data points. In addition, some of the old data points, the retention period was actually shortened. So where in the past, for example, who is data had to be retained for the term of the registration plus 3 years, it's now the term of the registration plus 2 years. So those are, I think, the two kind of fundamental changes that are made in this new specification. And so the question is about what happens in the case where a registrar has a conflict between their applicable law in their jurisdiction and what the RAA is basically telling them to do. And so there was a recognition throughout the negotiation of the agreement that this was a possibility. And so the specification itself includes a provision by which a registrar can come to ICANN and say, I have this conflict. I wish for ICANN to waive certain of the requirements to conflict with my local law. So that process is in place. It's in the agreement. That's always, been something that we've contemplated. So a total of, I think, 15 registrars have now invoked that process with ICANN, representing, I think, 8 or 9 different national jurisdictions. Of those, one has been through the entire process, and the process, I should say, that's specified in the agreement is that after the request is received, the registrar should also include some statement from their either their data privacy authority or some reputable law firm in their jurisdiction. They provide this, and typically what happens in practice is that ICANN reviews this and determines that there's probably more information needed. That's been kind of the case for all of these that we've received. And so by that I mean, registrars have submitted to us statements from either their local authority or a law firm or from the Article 29 Working Party that says, these requirements are in essence, they're problematic. There's a conflict. The part that we don't typically receive on the first go-round is the part that says, well, here's what we can do. And so that's really what I think what you're hearing from people in the community is that that's a really hard discussion to have because it's not entirely clear based on, most jurisdictions' laws that we've looked at. So the process is it's been described by some as negotiation, but I think it's really more of a clarification of what the state of the law is between ICANN and the registrar. And so we've been engaged in that process with all of the registrars who have submitted these requests for waiver. As I said, one of these waiver requests went through the entire process, and then as required by the specification, it was posted for 30 days to ICANN.org. We opened up a comment period for people to submit comments on that. And generally, while anybody is free to comment, the comments that might be have an effect on this are ones that might say something like, you misinterpreted the law, or, there's some issue here that we think that you weren't aware of. It could be that they think the registrar misinterpreted the law, however it is. And so those are the sorts of comments that we're sort of expecting might have an impact on the preliminary waiver that's granted. So after that 30 days passes, I'm sorry, this is such a long answer. I said it was complicated, didn't I? So after the 30 days passes, it generally will then become final. If we've received comments that indicate we need to change something, that's our opportunity to do that. So a French registrar went through the process and was granted their waiver. A Belgian registrar went through the process and is currently in that posting period. So assuming that there's no comments that come in that suggest we've made a mistake, then that one would also be granted and we continue. There are a few other registrars who are, I think, kind of getting close to that part of the process. So I think it's been kind of a slow-going thing. I know that it's been challenging, I think, from the registrar perspective, and frankly, it's challenging from the ICANN perspective, too. This is just really difficult stuff. And, we're trying to talk to people in those countries to get insight into, whether what the registrar is providing to us is accurate or if they haven't provided us enough, if they can help sort of augment what we've got in front of us. So a very long answer. I hope I answered the question. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. I'm Adeo Abril from CoreHub. I had one question, but now I have two. Going back to the answer to Werner's question before, sorry, but I got lost because I got two answers. One answer, I think, I don't know who was, but from compliance, perhaps Owen, I don't know the name, was something like each registration must be verified or validated. The other question is, well, no, if it's already been validated, that concrete data set, that concrete email address in that case, that's it. So just for, you know, for a stupid person like me, if we have a customer registering 1,000 domain names, we'll need to validate. And then when it comes to Huey's accuracy, to verify those emails one by one, even if it's exactly the same data, or just once, and then we have it, and you know, all the subsequent registration we have from that customer, that's okay. Sorry, but they got lost.
If I could answer that, I misspoke, and specification, what I think it was paragraph four or three states that unless you have additional, you don't have to do the validation and verification if it's identical information. And the registrar has no information to suggest that it's inaccurate.
So it's enough having verified. Okay, thanks
a
lot. Now, back to everybody's favorite topic, the data retention and specification. No, here I have a different topic. We have requested a waiver. We are following the all the procedures that have been described. I don't know who was talking. I think it was Mike, but sorry, I cannot see faces from the distance. Just one side note, we would prefer dealing with ICANN than dealing with outside lawyers, but, you know, life is as it is. We have one problem, though, is that ICANN is only willing to discuss one aspect of the data retention article, which is 4.3, sorry, and it is how long. And now they are accepting to discuss the purpose of the data set. But for us, there is a much important point, which is 3.4.3, which is to whom we may disclose, or we are forced or allowed to disclose the data. Because if we don't I mean, if we only keep the data for the sake of keeping the data, doesn't make any sense. Indeed, for the customer itself may help. But the real interest in Article 3.4 is when in 3.4.3 it says that we must give the data to ICANN upon reasonable notice, without specifying the reasons that ICANN may have, that may probably be perfectly legitimate. And then at the end of that paragraph says, and ICANN may disclose that or shall not disclose unless ICANN wants to disclose to third parties. That's the summary of that part. And then in the middle, there is something saying, well, you know, in case that you think that the request from ICANN to send the data to ICANN, it's not according to the national law, you will engage in good faith negotiations to discuss the limitations, the guarantees, the protections for that disclosure. Okay, let me tell you that what's absolutely clear in most European legislation is that we cannot give any post-contractual data to ICANN. So the first question is why this cannot be addressed in the waiver. And the second one, if it's not addressed, what's the point of the waiver? If we again need to discuss each time whether we should send the data or not, when the answer is very clear, no. And the third question is the more important for this session here. What's this good faith procedure? Should we discuss that with compliance, with legal, with Jones Day? How we will discuss each and every time for this useless waiver, if we cannot include the disclosure, whether this is within the legislation or not? Legislation that probably the people in the table and most people in ICANN staff will not know, because you don't have that many lawyers in based in, you know, trained in EU law, for instance, or Spanish law, Swiss law, Argentinian law, etc. So how will this work? Well, I mean, it won't, but how do you think this would work?
So at my count, that's like five questions, so I'll do my best to answer all of them. But by all means, if I miss something, I'm operating on about 1 hour of sleep, so feel free to keep me honest here. You know, one of the things that you mentioned was that is part of this process. We've asked our outside counsel to talk to registrar's counsel about these waiver requests. And so the way that this originally sort of was envisioned is that it wouldn't be quite as complicated as it is, and we would have, you know, we would do our bit of research on the matter, and we would have our registrar relations staff would go back to the registrar and say, okay, here's your waiver. And so what we learned through this is that, first of all, you know, it's extremely complicated. And second of all, I think there's perhaps a perception among some registrars that we don't understand the complexity of it, and we absolutely we do understand the complexity of it. And in fact, it seems to have made the process more efficient by having outside counsel do this. And just so it's clear, although I think it's well known, our outside counsel is Jones Day. For most of these, we've got actually European counsel who are quite well versed in these topics, who are the ones engaging with the registrar's attorneys. And so, from my perspective, it seems really helpful to have people who are talking the same language, talking to each other. They're talking the privacy laws and these things that are quite complicated. So that was sort of the thinking. It's not an intent to try to chill the dialogue. In fact, it seems to be helping to make the dialogue smoother. But by all means, we're always happy to take feedback on those sorts of things. There was another issue that you mentioned about the purpose for retaining data and the purpose for potentially ICANN disclosing data. And so I'm not an expert on the paragraph 3.4.3 that you're referring to, but in the 2009 RAA, it was a considerably shorter provision, and it basically said that registrars would make data available to ICANN upon request for inspection and copying, and that was in the previous agreement too. And so the newer version makes clear that this idea of making data available for inspection by ICANN might be impractical. A registrar can say, that's fine, come to my office, it's in, it's on Antarctica or someplace that's really impractical for us to reach. So what the agreement now says is that if the compliance team makes a reasonable request, the registrar will provide the data. And then there's this carve out that says, however, if you have reason to believe there's some legal thing that prevents you from doing this, we're going to engage in that good faith discussion over it. I think that this is the purpose of ICANN having access to this data has never been to disclose it to third parties. It's always been about compliance enforcement and monitoring. So I think there might be ways for us to address this just through either clarification or an affirmative statement by ICANN at the time of the request saying this is our intended purpose of it. So that might be something that we can solve without having to go through an entirely new data waiver request process. So that's that. But about the purpose of the data that's being collected and retained by registrars, one thing I just thought I would point out is that last week ICANN posted a document for public comment that is intended to try to help clarify, what we mean when we say the purpose of this data. And in fact, if you look at the correspondence from the Article 29 Working Party, they say, it doesn't state in the contract why this data is being collected. And, we understand that. And so that's really what we're trying to address for not just the Working Party, but for the world is, we believe there are valid reasons for collecting this data, but it's not necessarily that ICANN staff should be the sole dictionary of purpose or the sole definer of that purpose or clarifier. So what we wanted to do was put that out for, public comments that others who might have ideas that things that we didn't consider could also have input into that process. So hopefully that's helpful, and it's not at all intended to make the process harder. It's intended to make it so that data privacy authorities and as well as, the attorneys who are considering these difficult issues have that data point that maybe they didn't have or that they felt they couldn't rely on because it wasn't stated someplace in writing. Finally, and I think maybe this is sort of no longer really relevant, but I think that, in the event that you have a request from ICANN for data, it would be to that person who's made the request. If you have an issue about that request where you believe it conflicts with your legal ability to comply, it would be with that person that you'd want to raise that issue. There's not a new waiver process that you would need to follow for that. So please tell me if I've answered all of your questions.
Yes, thanks. I'll give you an example. I mean, we have no issues with Jones Day in general or with the specific lawyer we had. Quite the contrary. Our lawyer, so to speak, the one we had is, and we are still having, is a very reasonable person. And for instance, she completely agrees with us that we cannot disclose the data to ICANN. in any way with any protection. We cannot allow ICANN to see the data in our offices because this is expressly forbidden by our legislation. Only law enforcement agencies. If ICANN gets a law enforcement badge or TLD or something, then we could discuss. Now, when we address this issue with her, you know, I said, well, I will ask ICANN. And she comes back saying, ICANN doesn't allow me to talk about that with you. This cannot be part of the discussion. This is why I'm saying it's not very helpful sometimes to have these intermediaries because we want to discuss with the real party whether we can discuss. If she has orders not to discuss a point, that's the end of the discussion. Okay? And the reverse, well, I just want tell ICANN compliance, they can take a note that CoreHub will never provide post-contractual data to ICANN. So if you want to strike compliance now, you may do it. But there is no way we can do it. And if the negotiation doesn't work, I mean, we will send you the DPA, the Digital Protection Agency, to tell you why. Okay?
Thanks, Amadeo. I think that's actually very helpful feedback. We'll take that back.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Perrin, and I'm with the NCUC. And my question is about how you manage the individuals' personal data access rights under this particular regime. So if I'm understanding this correctly, and my apologies, I'm not an expert on how you do compliance whatsoever. My expertise is in data protection law. So you, ICANN, in your compliance department, have to comply with my access request as an individual to information about how you decided to let law enforcement have access to my data, and so does the registrar, right? So is there a common procedure for this, and who bears the costs of these subject data access rights?
So I think that's a very valid question, but it's not one that I don't think any of us are prepared to give you an answer to, I'm afraid. It's a little bit beyond the scope of just the RAA, but I'd be happy to try and get an answer back to you on that.
But you do that right now in the compliance department, right? So it's not as if this is new.
So what I think is new is, at least to me, is this notion of an individual coming to ICANN and asking for information about their information. It's not that it's new, but that I have no knowledge of it. And I think it's just kind of beyond the scope of what we here on the front can speak to today.
And this is Owen. You know, for the stuff that compliance has, that is kept confidential. Nobody gets access to that information. That's not anything that'd be requested through a DDP or anything like that. That is all internal to ICANN.
Okay, so that's okay as far as that goes, but it doesn't cover your data subject access rights. Anyway, I'll pursue this offline. Thanks.
We have two questions from remote participant Marcus Schaefer from HostServer. And the first one is there a time frame for revalidation of email addresses, such as after one or two or more years?
And this is Owen, for the record. That would have to be, there would be no time frame in there in that contract unless the registrar has information to suggest that that it is inaccurate.
And Marcus's second question is, as a registrar under the 2013 RAA, am I allowed to do the email verification before updating the WHOIS data to prevent the domain names from being suspended if email verification failed, or do no WHOIS update if the verification fails?
Again, this is Owen. For that, we see those types of things going on concurrently, not doing one and then waiting for that response and coming back and then doing the next. You know, that's something where you would, you know, send the email and then doing the other validation or who is updating and then doing the verification validation that are required for that.
And we now have another remote participation question from Gavin. Can ICANN expand on the accepted methods for data validation? Is it clear that physical address format is outlined, which is fine? However, does ICANN require or expect validation of address accuracy with third-party data validation provider?
This is Owen. The WHOIS accuracy program specification lays out the requirements for that, whether that's the telephone number has to conform to ITU standards. I don't recall exactly what all of them are, but they're listed there in that. Caitlin put that slide up. So that's what it needs to go through. There's many different ways that registrars can ultimately achieve that type of validation, whether it's something to do manually, Credit card validation software can do that. There's lots of solutions for doing that. And that's until there's the cross-field validation, which would further enhance that.
Hi. Kathy Kleiman again, non-commercial users constituency. First, thank you. Thank you for the detailed answer. Thank you for your time. This is difficult material and new ground for us, which is why, I mean, for all of us, for the community, for you. Which is why I want to ask the question. There's a lot of time and effort going in, of yours, of the registrars, of registrants. Are there metrics being kept? And if so, when might we see them? The metrics being kept about whether all this time and effort is achieving the purpose for which these rules were adopted?
From a compliance perspective, we are keeping a number of metrics on all of those things that are coming in the new 2013 RAA complaints. We have different resolve codes for why we would close a complaint, and we are keeping track of that. For some of the more, say, high-profile complaints, heightened interest in the community, such as abuse or privacy proxy, we have additional resolve codes that we might do, as opposed to, say, some complaint types might have a less number, so that we could gather that data. And I do know that there's a WHOIS accuracy study that's going on, which will look for a scope of not just sampling some domains. It's going to be specifically targeted to do geographic differences, registrar differences, big, small, 2013 RAA versus 2009 RAA. That's not anything that compliance is tracking, and it would be difficult for us to do just as a global basis, but that is something that's anticipated in that study, and they should be able to draw some conclusions about whether WHOIS data is more accurate under the 2009 RAA versus the 2013 RAA.
But if I might follow up, verification and validation, that the accuracy is for a purpose, not for its own not in and of itself, but for a purpose involving law enforcement and others. Are those kinds of metrics being kept with that this new accuracy is serving, again, the purposes, the underlying purposes for which these rules were adopted?
That's outside of the compliance scope. We process complaints. I mean, that's a policy thing that would have to be handled outside of at least compliance. I don't know if that's something that...
This is Mike Zepke again. I was just going to point out that this question was also asked by registrars when they met with the board on Tuesday, and I'm at risk of misstating what the answer was to them. They raised this question directly with Fadi, and he did mention that work is underway with the law enforcement community in particular to try to do some tracking and reporting of that sort of thing. I don't know that we have more specific information than that, but I think that it's clearly a matter that's been raised by others, and it's something that's important. So it is something that we ICANN, and I think the big ICANN, everybody in this ICANN community is probably going to be sort of looking toward.
Great. I wasn't in that meeting, so thank you.
We have an additional question on the chat from Marcus Schaefer. Is ICANN in compliance with the Safe Harbor program for data transferred to ICANN?
So this is Mike. The safe harbor provision, as I understand it, is a set of, requirements have been put in place between governments so that if you're a U.S. Organization, by complying with these requirements, European organizations in particular are able to transfer data to you. And the I think they're fairly specific requirements, so I don't know that that's something that we've actually gone into detail to address, but I think that's why that provision in the RAA allows the registrar to raise that question of compliance with their applicable law for data exchange.
Graham's letting me come to the mic before him. The Safe Harbor Agreement doesn't apply to nonprofits, so ICANN can't use it. This is Stephanie Perrin again for the record.
So then that would be a no. Thank you.
Hi, Graham Bunton from TUCAS. We were talking about this in the registrar session the other day, but I'm hoping compliance can give us a bit more context into how they're interpreting some of the specifications within the RAA. Around if we get a WHOIS complaint, that has to kick off an email verification process, especially considering A, our investigation may reveal there are no inaccuracies, or B, that the WHOIS complaint is originally about postal code. Why would that kick off the verification process?
Well, let me just bring this up here. I'm just looking at and bring up the RA here so I can quote it so I'm not speaking out of kind here. Who is accuracy program specification for reads, if a registrar has any information suggesting that the contact information specified in section 1A through 1F is incorrect, and that is all of the contact information that appears in the WHOIS output, then the registrar must verify or re-verify the email address. It's not limiting to, I know during the discussion with the registrars, they said the intent was that it would only apply to the email address, but that's not how I read that in the contract, and I don't see where it just limits it to just the email address. It does specify all of the contact information in the WHOIS. I do know that there are some other discussions on this, and ICANN is taking this back to consider this further, but that's, you know, compliance stays out of policy. We just look at what the contract is. It's not that as exciting. We don't get engaged in those kinds of discussions. We just go by what is written in the contract and not what parties thought was or was not going to be included in there. And that's a pretty clear read of that. If there's that unintended result, then we certainly will take that under advisement. And I've checked with legal, and there are, you know, will be some things that we'll take back and consider after this meeting.
Great. I look forward to the output of those conversations. Thanks.
Hi, this is Stephanie Perrin again, and again, I apologize. This is a naive question, but even after a year working on the expert working group on the WHOIS new model, I can't get my head around how this process goes through, this process being the negotiation of the RAA agreement, without consulting end users, registrants, the grand public, as they say, in a more fulsome manner. So can you explain to me how, when the agreement was finally agreed, you consulted with the end users? Because basically what you're doing is signing away their third-party rights through a contract between the registrar and ICANN. And if the registrar chooses to invoke the data protection agreement, and that will vary depending on how they do it, there could be plenty of instances where the registrars are in fact violating the data protection law, just nobody's noticed, and they haven't applied for the exemption. So I'm really confused, and after years in government, I know that government would at least have to do a regulatory impact assessment and consult on this to see what the impact on the stakeholders, the end users, is. And I don't mean this as criticism. I'm just really mystified.
So this is Mike again. I would be happy to sort of talk a little bit to the process by which we arrived at this agreement. I think that might help to answer some of the question. So when I started ICANN back in 2005, we had the 2001 RAA, and that was in place until 2009, so that one survived a very long time. But I think that all throughout, there was recognition among people in the community and on staff that there were changes that were needed, largely for the protection of registrants. There were a number of issues, such as this concept of there being backdoor accreditations, where a registrar who couldn't get accredited by ICANN could go and buy another registrar and suddenly was accredited. And there were a number of issues that were raised in that round where we got to the 2009 RAA that were, you know, viewed as, you know, basically wins for consumers, and these were all improvements basically for registrant protections. As part of that process, the GNSO provided a good amount of input, and a lot of their suggestions didn't make it into the negotiated agreement. And so we kicked off, after that round closed, another process by which the GNSO was able to come up with recommendations for the next iteration of the agreement. And so a number of those recommendations made it into the 2013 RAA. But also, you know, very frankly, a good number of the recommendations came from a statement by the law enforcement community saying we have these 12 recommendations that we think should be included in the agreement. So that was a very their statement was very widely received within the ICANN world, and so the end user community, I can understand what you're saying, is not necessarily quite as plugged in, despite the fact that there are different avenues within ICANN that do represent end users. So in any event, much of this was community generated, whether it was through this law enforcement paper or whether it was through discussions with the GAC or whether it was through this GNSO process. That's where the bases for these amendments came from. And then throughout the negotiation, there were various points at which the negotiated provisions were put up for public comment. So there were public comment opportunities throughout. I think the bigger concern that you're raising is that it's a very complicated thing, and the average end user is probably completely unaware of it. And I'm not quite sure how that gets solved.
Before I give this over to Elliot, I just want to say that I think that the risk here is extremely high. I could probably in 24 hours get a massive Twitter campaign to complain, and you'd be dying in privacy complaints, and so would all the registrars. And that's something they really don't want to have to deal with, I think, because as someone who's been at the pointy end of that, when you start getting thousands and thousands of privacy complaints, you don't get to just toss them and ignore it as spam, you know?
You know, and Stephanie, I think that might be actually a great thing to do. I'd love to have that inundation and flow it down to these guys because, Mike, that was...
Elliot, I'm trying to get along here, you know?
No, I'm... Well, I got to say, that was historical revisionism of the worst kind. To describe either 2009 or 2013 RAA revisions as anything but driven by IP and law enforcement, but, instead to try and characterize them as, registrant and consumer protection is a crock from my perspective. I think that having been through both of those negotiations, both of those comment periods in very painful detail, there was no question who was driving the other side of this agenda. And I think that the proper characterization can only be, and I'm happy to do this on a point-by-point basis, both looking at clause changes and outcomes, and behaviors and what was being enforced and what wasn't, that in fact it was the registrars who were almost on every provision lined up with civil society, lined up with privacy experts like Stephanie in favor of registrants' rights, and you had IP and law enforcement in favor of more restrictive controlling provisions, almost without exception. So I think that was just a PR gross mischaracterization, is frankly surprising from you.
And on that, Elliot, you get the last word because we are about out of time. But thank you for that. And thank you all for attending. I just want to mention that the registrars have that resource for asking questions about interpreting the RAA, raaquestions@icann.org. So with that, I say thank you and enjoy the rest of the meeting.